The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. And despite anything you may have heard on this podcast earlier this season, the Nations League is nothing more than a set of glorified friendlies that mean absolutely nothing. So it doesn't matter that England lose another semi-final, another one in which they were leading at half-time, another one in which they struggled to keep hold of the football. We'll also dissect the best VAR of all time from the first semi-final, while offer our exasperated frustration in response to those England fans. The Women's World Cup begins today. Susie Rack joins us from Paris to discuss the favourites, ones to watch out for, and to give us the latest on the mood from the England camp ahead of their first game on Sunday against Scotland. Elsewhere, an agreement in place for Hazard. Christian Eriksen wants a new challenge. We'll round up the transfers. And there is way too much FIFA UEFA admin for Philippe to cut down to his allocated time slot. All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Philippe Auclair, nice to see you.
Very nice to see you, Max.
How quickly do we have to race through the actual football to get to your legally worrying statements about the organisers of this beautiful game?
I think 5-10 minutes should be okay.
Excellent news. A tweet from someone, and I've lost who sent it, my apologies, says, between refusing to give up his age and refusing to reveal his meatball recipe, I'm convinced Lars Sivertsen is actually an 88-year-old grandmother. How would you react to that, Lars?
I mean, my voice maybe sounded like that on Monday. I wasn't feeling myself, but...
But you still won't tell us your age?
No.
Okay. Hey, Barry.
Hello.
Earlier today, I welled up. It was an early flight. I got back from Portugal, and I saw a short video of someone putting some tiny glasses on a hedgehog, and it actually made me weep slightly, and I tweeted it out, and someone very kindly tweeted a picture of it next to a picture of you, and the resemblance is uncanny.
Yes, the somebody in question was Stephen Chicken, who works for the Huddersfield Examiner, I think it is, formerly of Football 365. Thanks for that, Stephen. The likeness was, well, you said, what I need in my life now is a baby owl wearing thick black glasses.
Hedgehog.
A baby hedgehog wearing thick black glasses. And Stephen pointed out, how can you want what you already have?
Makes me want to tickle your little belly. The Netherlands 3, England 1. England cruelly dealt a blow by the fact that Jesse Lingard's feet are too big, and if he just wore size 2s, then it would have been a fantastic England victory. Nothing to dissect, no problems with England's midfield. Everything is beautiful in the world of English football. Philippe, your thoughts?
First thought is that I actually enjoyed this game more than I enjoyed the European finals, which is a bit unusual. We tend to say that international football is not quite what it used to be. The level is not that great and so forth. But
to be fair, it could hardly have been worse.
That's very true. But you never know. The same caveats we had about the finals being played so long after the end of the domestic season also applied to those two national teams. But we didn't see the effect of that. I mean, for example, Harry Kane looked far livelier when he came on after halftime than he had done for Tottenham in the Champions League final. I'm like everybody wondering whether this tournament has really any significance whatsoever, as you were saying, now that England has lost. You will remind me, how many semi-finals is that now?
It's the League Cup of international football. If you decide it's important, then it's important. Mm-hmm. If you lose, you can say it doesn't matter.
It's 4 semi-finals in my lifetime, I think. I guess in 50 years it might matter, you know, because it might have become a thing. It's certainly been better than international friendlies. Before we start analysing, you know, how Dutch players are coached compared to English players and Frenkie de Jong versus Fabian Delph. Barry?
That's not fair.
Okay, that's oversimplifying it. But is there a case for proper football men to stand up and say there is a time when you can just get rid?
Well, I think we saw that last night. England's defenders struggle under pressure to play the ball out from the back. They're not technically good enough, and it cost them dearly. It could have cost them a couple of other occasions as well.
You say under pressure. I mean, John Stones wasn't under pressure, was he?
But, you know, even at times when they weren't conceding sloppy goals, you could see they were struggling to play the ball out from the back under a heavy press, a heavy high press from the Dutch. And they don't have the technique, say, of, I was going to say they don't have the technique of Manchester City players, but then John Stones is a Manchester City player, although tellingly he didn't feature for them very often in the second half of the season.
Yeah, first start since the 20th of April when he started against Spurs in the league. He's just started six matches since January.
Yeah, and I think last night showed why. He's always had a mistake, a big mistake in him, and I think there was a school of thought that suggested that, you know, Pep had ironed that out of his game, but he had a poor performance last night, as did every single member of the England back four and several of their midfielders. The thing is, though, it was a really bad performance by them, but they still came within an inch of being 2-1 up with, what, 6 minutes to go?
And Sancho had that header which would have made it 2-0, so possible. Philippe?
Yeah, I mean, Stones, I think what worries me more about him is not so much the mistake, because De Ligt made also a terrible mistake for the Rashford penalty. It's more the fact that he completely went to pieces after that. Yeah. Is that there was, you could see that there was, he was so scared, terrified, that he was still wondering. He was still in the mistake, which is the one thing that makes me question his ability, well, not ability, but his capacity to play at this kind of level, more than the fact that, okay, he made a mistake, it can happen to anybody. It's not the first time that I've seen a defender lose the ball in those kind of situations. But afterwards, it was absolutely dreadful. You could see Pickford actually having a right go at him. You could see all his teammates actually looking at him, thinking, what is going on through your head?
But the third goal was...
Which is not helpful.
Yeah, it's not helpful. But the third goal is his mistake.
Also bad, yeah.
And the first goal is his mistake, is he loses his man.
The thing, I mean, I think the reason why there are all these mistakes is mental as much as technical. Because he is an excellent ball carrier and he can play the ball from the back. And when he's done it for Manchester City, he's done it quite well. So whether it's a case of fatigue, as Gareth Southgate says, or a case of not being quite up to the occasion, mentally speaking, I'd rather go for the second hypothesis myself.
And it is worth mentioning before we jump on John Stones' head and declare playing out from the back as always very stupid, is that when you're doing something that's slightly countercultural, which playing out from the back is in England, whenever it goes wrong, the immediate reaction will not be, we have to do this better, it will be, we have to do it differently, right? So when you concede the first goal, when you concede the goal from De Ligt, from the corner, no one says, well, man-marking has clearly failed, and we can't man-mark just because it failed in that instance. I mean, if you do it wrong, it just means you have to do it better. It's like the first season Guardiola was here, a lot of people were saying, well, this possession football doesn't work in England. Turns out they just had to do it better. So I don't think these mistakes mean England can never play out from the back. But it did remind me of something I tweeted during the World Cup last summer, that when England were playing like this in Russia, is like, I can see what they're doing, but watching England try to play out from the back still reminds you of watching a person with bronchitis building a house of cards. Like, I mean, it could work for a while, but you'd feel like disaster is always very close at hand.
It's interesting you've come to a stage, Lars, where you're now tweeting your own quoting your own humorous. I remember the great Lars Sivertsen.
Can I draw your attention to Monday's pod?
Yeah.
In which,
the only thing I did hear on the radio at the weekend, I forget who it was, some pundit saying, oh, well, the Dutch are nothing to worry about, you know, the Portuguese, that's when the real test comes. And all my sort of England catastrophe spidey senses started tingling at the same time.
Yes, and this, so it's really, I think it was Waddle, I'm pretty sure, apologies to Waddle if it wasn't him. And, I mean, you tempted the wrath of the whatever from high atop the thing.
You're not just quoting yourself, you're now playing out audio clips of yourself, Lars.
I won't do that again.
It's become too much. This is Welcome to the Lars Sivertsen Show. Joining Lars today, Philippe Auclair, Max Rushton and Barry Glendenning. The midfield have been criticised, Barry. Delph Barkley and Rice.
I think that's fair. Rice is clearly a good player, if a little treacherous, and but I think last night showed how far he has to go yet, because you know the performance of De Ligt, say, England's midfield struggled, and I think, you know, while people have been quick to hang various defenders out to dry, the midfielders deserve a certain amount of culpability as well, because, you know, were they giving them the options to
pass?
Well,
that's it. You've got to want the ball. I was chatting to a few people afterwards about that, about the point that you need your midfielders to come short and want the ball and be able to look after the ball like De Jong clearly can. And actually, I was pitch side. and the Dutch team were warming up and they were doing the thing called a rondo, right?
Rondo,
it's
yeah.
Keep ball, right? It's keep ball, keep ball, keep
Piggy
ball,
in
keep
the
ball.
Middle.
But honestly, in a confined space, and I know it was just warm-up, but they were every single one of them. And it's possible that if the England team were doing it, they'd be as good in a warm-up. But just watching them and the time they had on the ball in this tiny square made you think, these guys are tremendous. And this has long been a conversation about England, is do we have a player who can do that? And the only one at the moment is maybe Harry Winks. He can do that. He's not as good as De Jong, clearly, but he does come short for the ball. He can look after the ball.
And he wasn't playing last night.
And he wasn't playing. And I can understand why Southgate didn't pick him, right? Because he hadn't played for so long, even though he started.
I think technically somebody like James Maddison would have the talent to do that.
But he would play in a... He plays in a... You have to bring
yes,
Maddison
I know,
deeper,
I know.
Right?
I'm just trying to think. And, you know, Adam Lallana, for example.
Tom says, presumably we just spend the next 2 years praying to Cruyff that Phil Foden is everything we dream of him being.
Well, the thing that's fascinating about Winks is that, both for Spurs and England, he's become this really important guy, maybe beyond his abilities, just because he does something that no one else does. It reminds me of a number of years back when there was weirdly a dearth of holding midfielders in England, and suddenly Gareth Barry became like the most important player in the universe for the England team for a very, very short space of time. Because Winks is not amazing, Winks is not Xavi, but Winks does have that ability to control the pace of the game a little bit and spray passes around, and England really lack a midfielder like that at the moment.
You could also say, I mean, I'm thinking that Liverpool just won the Champions League with midfield that doesn't have a player like the one you say England is missing. They have Fabinho, they have James Milner, they have Jordan Henderson, Gigi Wijnaldum, who is a good player, but...
Sorry. No, I was just going to interject that they play slightly differently, though. It's this high-pressing, high-tempo. Like Liverpool, we see this time and time again, they're so much less comfortable when they have to control games against opponents who sit deep. That's not what they do best.
So should England look at that?
I mean, but they've decided now that they want to play with the patient build-up. And if you look at the sort of England DNA that was put out a few years back, you know, keeping possession and being confident with the ball was a really big part of that. It's a long-term plan of changing the way football is played in this country. And I think changing that on the back of one performance is maybe not ideal. There are questions to be asked if whether trying to become something that is a little bit countercultural is a bit odd. Maybe you should sit down and look, okay, what kind of intrinsic qualities do we have in this country? What is our football all about? And you'd say it's maybe more about pace and power than control and new and subtlety and technical ability. But, you know, this is where we are.
And just to carry on that, I mean, the disallowed goal, which was disallowed for, you know, a toe, came from building from the back, actually, quite bravely building from the back and then having very quick transitions and excellent finishing. So
if you play hoofball and you lose and it doesn't come to it, people say, oh, well, you know, this and that could have been done better and blah, blah, blah. But no one says, oh, we have to completely change the culture. Whereas when you try to play this way, it looks really... Some things in football, if you do it wrong, it looks really stupid. And that is somehow almost worse than just failing normally.
Gareth Southgate's getting some criticism. It didn't start any of the Champions League players. Koeman did. But overall, he's going in the right direction, isn't he? There was that great win in Spain. Getting to the Nations League finals, for what they're worth, is an improvement. Beating Spain and Croatia is beating two good football teams that we haven't done that for quite a long time.
Well, they didn't beat Croatia when it mattered in the semi-final of the World Cup. And I thought last night's defeat was strikingly similar. Going a goal down, being overrun in midfield. Going a goal up, being overrun in midfield. And ultimately losing 2-1 on the back of some poor errors. And... So if you're asking, is that a mark of progress, you'd have to say, no, it isn't, because they're exactly where they were a year ago, Patrick, losing in a semi-final in identical circumstances.
So it's exactly the same. So they haven't gone up at all or down, right? Okay, just on the level like that.
They are a good team. I think people got a bit carried away last summer. I've said that
I did
consistently ever since, but they're... They need to crank it up another notch.
Patrick says, will you ever see a better example of a group of people not wanting to be somewhere as much as on the pitch at the third place playoff on Sunday? I mean, I guess, do you need to have that game?
You were on an EasyJet flight at 6 a.m. in the morning today, Max. I mean, that might have also been a group of people.
I was desperate to appear on the Lars Sivertsen show.
Of course.
What can I say? The trouble off the pitch, I don't think anyone's surprised. Are they lots of trouble in Porto on Wednesday night? Trouble in Guimarães last night as well. Comes a week after the FA released their Don't Be That Idiot campaign, which is actually quite a good name for a campaign as well.
And again, you could make the comparison with what happened in the Champions League final, where there was absolutely no problem whatsoever.
Yeah, and that I was in Madrid, and there was, and it was, it is striking. It is really striking. And you know, I don't know what, how do we fix it?
Well, we all know what the reason is.
Carry on.
It's not very perhaps correct to say that, but it's not the same fan base. That's all. You've got people for the national team. And people who follow football. Two different things. And I'm afraid that the support for the national team in England has had this for a very, very long time.
Yeah. Well,
it's not
that,
you know,
now,
you shouldn't paint everybody with the same brush, but I know. But it is quite striking that the fact you had how many tens of thousands of Tottenham and Liverpool supporters in Madrid, who have fringe elements who are not necessarily great people, by the way, but who seem to have a great time, engage with each other, engage with the locals. Had a lot to drink, though. It was very hot, and there was absolutely no trouble. I mean, there has to be... We keep talking about the England support and these problems, people saying it's a minority, but it is quite a sizable minority of people, these idiots, and they follow the national team.
I think it's absurd to suggest that just because there was little or no trouble between Liverpool and Spurs fans... that there isn't a problem at club level, because we've seen lots of teams disgrace themselves, supporters disgrace themselves on their travels at European club matches. Leicester spring to mind, just one off the top of my head. There are many, many more. But the England fans are particularly scurrilous. And I'm not sure you can be stopped short of England not playing abroad.
Do you think it's worse now? Than it is, because I was at the World Cup in 2006 as a fan. I didn't work in this industry at all. And at the Trinidad and Tobago game, there was a lot of racism towards the Trinidad fans and the Trinidad players. There was that sort of general air of aggressive air. You know, not people getting arrested, but just a lot of aggressive people that weren't pleasant to be around. I was playing cards with some friends and people were like just saying... shouting, you know, behind us in a bar, calling us gay for playing cards and all. It was totally ridiculous. And then last night, you're in the ground and in the toilet and they're pissing in the sink and all these kind of things. And it's quite an aggressive atmosphere. But I wonder if social media just amplifies it. All the journalists like to take a photo and tweet out the video, and then lots of people say, oh, this is terrible. But I wonder if it's the same as it was 15 years ago, or better or worse?
Does it matter? It's clearly antisocial. You know,
no,
going
not.
What about 15 years ago is pretty unhelpful. I mean, these people, the vibe I get is that there are hundreds, and it is hundreds of England fans who genuinely see nothing wrong with occupying rather than visiting, having a drink in, occupying the square of a foreign city, singing obnoxious songs, behaving obnoxiously towards the locals, getting absolutely shit-faced drunk and pissing in fountains and whatnot. And then they feel hard done by when the local constabulary, you know, rightfully suspecting there's going to be trouble, line up and sort of in an intimidating way. Because they're behaving atrociously. But they will claim, oh, we did nothing wrong.
Portuguese schools closed early in Guimarães yesterday.
I heard that, yeah.
I mean, that is so depressing, isn't it?
But I should stress as well that the behaviour at home is much better than it used to be. This is a problem with the travelling support. At Wembley, I haven't seen problems like that myself.
Mm. Portugal 3, Switzerland 1 in the other game. Three classic Ronaldo goals, all different. Can anyone say anything new about him? I was there, and it's obvious that Portugal fans love Ronaldo, but wow, they love him. I mean, the adulation for him, I don't think anyone has loved me, not one person has loved me as much as the Portugal fans loved him in that stadium. It was the noise whenever he did anything was extraordinary.
But it seems weird to say it, but even though he scored three goals and had that wonderful no-look pass to set up Felix or Felix didn't score, but you know, he played him through this wonderful no look. But I thought he had a poor game. That's how ridiculous it is. That's how good he is. He scored three goals, and I still think it was one of the poorer games I've seen him play.
But that is, from the football perspective, the fascinating thing about his later career, how he sort of morphed from an enormously talented and rampaging winger into someone who's just a pure predator, really, who can spend his whole game doing not much and then suddenly decide it with a couple of goals. And that's, he's retooled himself in that manner, which is a fascinating thing, and it's clearly something that's working out very well for him.
The best bit of this game, I don't know if anyone else agrees, is the most sensational bit of VAR that has ever happened in the history of football. There was a claim for a penalty for the Swiss. It looked like quite a soft challenge, but the Swiss players were up in arms. The ref waved away the protest. It goes to the other end. Bernardo Silva is hacked down. The referee gives a penalty. The Swiss players crowd around him while the Portugal players are pretty relaxed. They've got a penalty. The Swiss players crowd and crowd and crowd until he says, "I'm going to look at the telly." Suddenly, the Swiss players take a step back and the Portugal players surround him as if to say, "You don't need to have a look at that telly, Mr. Referee." And it was interesting because a lot of complaints are made about in the stadium. Do you know what's happening? And even though you don't have replays of the moments, everyone there knew exactly what was happening. And maybe for a fan of either side, it might have been terrible or agonizing or whatever. But as a neutral, it was truly wonderful to see him go, "Oh, actually, it's a penalty at the other end."
How much time was there between the two decisions, or between the two actions, shall we say?
Between the two actions?
10 or 15 seconds.
Not a lot of time, yeah. Okay. Maybe a bit longer than that, but it wasn't long, was it?
I've always been a little bit dismissive of the fans don't know what's going on argument, because I think that will solve itself a little bit when we get used to VAR. Like, we'll see an incident that might be contentious and you'll kind of expect the ref to stop and them to have a look at it. Like, I think we'll get used to that. Loads of times in a game when the ref blows up, you don't know exactly what he's blown for and you just sort of accept it and get on with it. I think culturally, when we get used to VAR being there, I don't think that'll be the biggest problem. But I have some sympathy with the idea that you have an incident and then you have a penalty afterwards and then that gets ruled out because of... It reminds me of that game in Ligue 1 this season. I think it was Monaco against Marseille, where Marseille scored a goal and both teams made substitution because that changed the game state. One of the teams scored a goal anyway, and one team took off a centre forward, the other team took off a centre half and put on a centre forward because they thought the whole thing had changed, and then VAR ruled out the goal and suddenly the team who had to attack still didn't have a centre forward and the team who had to defend, you know, that sort of thing. Like, there are issues of things happening down the line whilst the VAR review is happening. I think that is a potentially, yeah, not great aspect of it. You know, as a side thing, if you find the highlights for this game, and if you're in the UK, I think Sky put them up on their YouTube thing, so you can watch them legally and it's all fine. Notice a number in the Switzerland centre half, Akanji, number 5, for the non-penalty after the real penalty. There's some of the most surreal defending I think I've ever seen, because I think he expects Ronaldo to shoot, so he sort of lies down on the ground for no reason in the middle of the area and then realizes that he hasn't shot and is trying to block off. It's really good.
He's just gone for a nap, has he?
It's very, very odd. So the Yunus Kabul Award for weirdest bit of defending of the year, I think, goes to Manuel Akanji there.
In Premier League news, some VAR decisions will be shown via video replays on giant screens if a, quote, definitive video clip is available.
How long will you take to find the definitive video clip?
Who's
going to
decide this and how do you do that? Like,
I don't mind.
It feels like something that'll put confusion, even more confusion, into the mix.
It will happen eventually. We're saying Switzerland were very good as well, actually, Shaqiri.
Yeah, Jordan Shaqiri was the best player on the pitch, I think. And if they had a decent centre-forward, they could have had it won at half-time. Harris Seferovic was playing up front for them. I don't know much about him, but he didn't look too good. I think he scored quite a lot of goals in the Bundesliga this season. No, sorry,
Portuguese
for Benfica.
Yeah.
He's a Benfica player. But I wasn't impressed with him at all.
Off the pitch, Cristiano Ronaldo's rape accuser has dropped charges against the footballer in a Nevada court in order to refile them in a federal court. Raphael Buschmann, a reporter for the German newspaper Der Spiegel, which initially reported Catherine Mayorga's claims, said the case is not closed. It is just at a different court now.
Well, you could be forgiven for thinking it was closed because that's how it was reported by practically everyone. I think Bloomberg ran first with the story, everyone else picked it up, and they all just said it had been dropped, which was incorrect.
Absolutely. And that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two in Paris, and we'll chat to Susie Rack ahead of the Women's World Cup that kicks off today. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Women's World Cup kicks off today in Paris. Susie Rack is there for us. Susie, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. I mean, you're there for the whole paper, not just for the pod. That's sort of inflating our sense of importance. and our FIFA announced that just over 941,000 tickets have been sold for this year's World Cup. Down on 2015's tournament in Canada, 20 of the 52 games have sold out. You wrote a piece saying that there doesn't seem to be much of a buzz around Paris. What's going on?
No, there's nothing really. I mean, you kind of walk around and it's just a normal day in Paris. If you ask pretty much anyone if there's some kind of sporting event going on, they'll say Roland Garros, because there's signs and posters for that absolutely everywhere. There's even signs up for the France men's team games in, I think it's September. But there's really very little for the women's team, which is a bit of a surprise, really, because, you know, the only way you kind of build up any sort of kind of feeling and buzz and getting people wanting to just be a part of something so that those less attractive fixtures sell out is if you kind of build a bit of hype around it. But there's none of that really here.
Has there been any explanation as to why there isn't?
Yeah, the opening ceremony press conference, I asked the CEO of the local organising committee, and he was very, very kind of bullish in his reply and said, you know, very, very dismissive of posters being around town centres and things, and said that they were focusing on filling stadiums and getting it to as many broadcasters as possible, and then boasted about selling out the 20 games, which isn't even one per team. So for me, that's not actually that great a figure. You know, 20 of 52 for a World Cup that they're hoping is going to be the biggest ever, for me, is a little bit disappointing.
Who do you think's going to win it?
So I was doing the little predictor the other day on FIFA website, and I came up with a Netherlands-France final. For me, it's really hard to look past France being home side. They're kind of a bit like the French team before the 2018 World Cup, the men's team, because they're sort of perennial bottlers. But like the timing being right for them, it sort of feels like the timing is right for this French team. The backbone of their squad is the core from the kind of all-conquering Lyon side, including, you know, four players that won the Champions League four or five times. So for me, it's hard to look past them as long as they can kind of cope with the pressure of being a home nation, the having the possibility of holding both the men's and women's World Cups for the first time ever. As long as they can deal with that, I think they've got to be the favourites. The US, obviously, are right up there. They're the holders. They've not got the most amazing team, but they know how to win, and they've got big game players. And they've, like I say, they've got this kind of sort of easy group that eases them into the tournament, which kind of will really help them gain momentum. There's sometimes where they've struggled early on, they've kind of built momentum through as tournaments have gone on. So those two, but if they both top their groups, they can meet fairly early on in the knockout. So then whoever wins that game is the one who's going to lift the trophy for me.
Philippe, I think Susie just called you a nation of bottlers there. How do you react?
Not anymore.
No, that's exactly it. Not anymore. And you said before the 2018 World Cup, and we saw what happened there. I mean, it's quite logical that they should be favourites, given the, you know, the players they've got. And also, Susie, I mean, when people talk about the results of the England team before the tournament, which are not very encouraging, the results of the French national team, on the other hand, have been pretty damn good. I mean, I think 13 wins out of 14 games before the tournament with Corinne Diacre. I just wanted to... I mean, we could talk for a very long time about that, because I was in Paris as well to see the great and good and not so great of FIFA and CAF over the last few days. And I saw absolutely no sign of anything related to the World Cup. In fact, I've seen more signs of the World Cup going, walking from Oxford Circus to Broadcasting House the other day, because they've got the whole shop windows, which is with pictures of the teams taking part in the World Cup. In France, there's absolutely nothing of that. Did you take part in some of the, let's congratulate ourselves on how great we are about the women's game in FIFA over the last few days, all this congress and talk shops and seminars that Gianni Infantino is regaling us with? Can you give us an idea of what the mood was like in there?
No, I went to the. I spent yesterday. It's going on today as well at the FIFA Women's Football Convention, which is a strange occasion because it's a really weird mix of people. You know, there's you've got kind of campaigners for women's football and women's sport in kind of different parts of the world, but then you've got, like you say, the senior guys and women at FIFA who. Seem to be totally removed from the reality of what it is actually like to be a woman football player on the ground in any country, and yeah, I mean it's a lot. It's just a lot of talk and not much action. A lot of back patting. A friend who was there sent me a little kind of FIFA Women's Football Convention bingo that she had drawn up of various. Various sound bites that she heard in Infantino's speech, which was quite funny, which included, like, I've got two kids, so now I care about women's football, that kind of stuff. which, you know, it just is really off-putting, obviously. What else? I'll find another one, because they're quite good. look how good we are, insert number of women who are now on the board or council. We've increased the prize money. The time to do something is now. I brought in the first strategy and the first women's football convention. All of this kind of stuff. They're all words. I hired one woman, so that's okay. That kind of attitude is just going around.
Some of my best wives are women. That's Infantino, yeah, isn't it?
Exactly.
Several of my moms. Susie, I found, I think, the exact quotes from Gianni on this one, which is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. He's as good as arithmetics. He's good at governing FIFA, obviously. He says, 80% of my household are women. One male and five females.
Oh, God.
Oh, dear.
Susie, back to the tournament itself, much as I love Infantino, for a lot of people this will be their first or one of their first exposures to women's football. Can you give us, you know, a few players to really look out for?
Yeah, so I mean, first off, Vivian Miedema, the Dutch forward, has been incredible for England for Arsenal this season. She broke the record for the most goals scored in a single season. She won PFA Player of the Year. She's a phenomenally good striker, and that Netherlands front four of her, Van der Sanden from Lyon, Van der Donk from Arsenal as well, and Lieke Martins, who was player of the tournament in the Euros, is probably the most exciting forward line in the whole competition. Then, like I say, you've got Erin Cuthbert at Scotland, who I think is really going to catch a few eyes. And then Khadija Shaw for Jamaica, who was the Guardians Player of the Year for 2018, because she's only 22. She scored 3 goals in 5 games to get Jamaica to their first ever World Cup. And she also has lost 4 brothers, 3 to gang-related violence, you know, while she'd been playing for her country. So she's like quite an exciting one to watch. She's been scoring quite a lot. Scored 2 against Scotland in their final game before the tournament starts. So they're some of the kind of really exciting ones to catch.
Is there a group of death? Because I'm a big fan of those in major tournaments.
Oh, that's a good question. I think England's is probably the toughest, but purely because of the rivalry with Scotland and the Scottish players knowing the English players inside out, and then having Japan, who are the runners-up last time out, who they played in SheBelieves and they beat quite comprehensively. But I think everyone is in, and all the team are pretty much in consensus that Japan deliberately put out a very weakened side in that. Another one that's really interesting is Germany, Spain and China, Group B, are all in the same group. And Germany and China always perform well. The Germans have been a little bit under the radar, but they've probably had one of the most consistent years going. And Spain, kind of nowhere 4 years ago, but because they've shot up domestically, and so much money is going into that league that their team is now actually quite strong. And then you've got the unknown of South Africa, who are at their first World Cup. So that's quite a tasty group of the groups. Probably England's group and Group B with Germany, Spain, and China in are probably the most exciting groups.
And if there are, you know, if somebody can't watch every single game in the group stages, are there certain games that you just absolutely have to watch?
Definitely Netherlands, Canada, which is the last game in Group E, which you know, determines who's going to top that group. Could really be quite a big test. You know, they're both teams that could go quite far in the tournament. Then you've got Japan, England. If Scotland get a result against England, then that game is going to be even more important and even more on a knife edge. And Sweden, the USA is the last game in Group F. I mean, in theory, they should have already wrapped up the top and second spots by then, but that will probably determine who finishes where, which will be quite important for kind of going through the knockout stages with an easier ride.
Susie, England are surfing into Nice on a wave of hype. Their chances of winning the tournament are being bigged up in the media, and they've got an opening game against a team no one is giving a chance in hell of beating them in Scotland. Are they setting themselves up for an ignominious failure like so many men's teams before them?
I've got a terrible sinking feeling that they might be.
No!
The chances are good. They've got a really good team. They've got a really strong squad. I mean, Scotland have seven players that are part-time players that have been given funding from the Scottish Government to be able to train full-time for the World Cup. You know, it's a massively massively big task then to get something out of England, but if any team can, you've got to think it's going to be Scotland. Their starting 11 is super strong. They've got Kim Little, who, well, in my mind, she's the best midfielder in the world, but she's definitely up there as one of the best. And they've got Aaron Cuthbert, who's just been incredible for Chelsea this season. She's a real big game player. She's only 22. She gets goals when it really matters. I don't know, you might have seen she scored a fantastic goal against Jamaica in their final their final friendly before the tournament a few days ago. And so, you know, they've got the chance to get something out of that game. And if they do, then it completely explodes that group and kind of really puts England in trouble, because if England top the group, they've got probably the kindest run they could have towards the final. But if they don't, they go into the kind of other side of the draw, which is really, really tough.
Are Scotland bringing lots and lots of fans with them? I've read that in places, because the men's team haven't been to a major tournament for a long time, that they're taking, you know, there will be a big Tartan Army presence there.
It's hard to tell. The ticket sales through the kind of Scottish national team are fairly low, but then through the FIFA website officially, there's been, you know, kind of 12,000 tickets sold or something like that, so it's hard to tell where they've gone. The impression is that there is going to be a fairly decent turnout. You'd hope there would be. It's, like I say, it's you know, the first time Scotland have qualified for a major tournament, well, a World Cup in a long time. Obviously, the women's team qualified for the Euros 2 years ago as well. I do think they could cause an upset against England. I do think they can really get something out of that game.
Susie, on England, Phil Neville in the games running up to this has notably rotated a lot, and we saw in the Lionesses documentary that he feels very strongly everyone should have a chance to show what they could do. But I mean, there is another side of that coin. Team cohesion is already difficult at international level since they don't have a lot of time together. What's your take on how they look lining up? Does Phil Neville know his best team? Do the players know how to play together? How's it all going to shape up?
He says he knows his best team. He's said for a while that he knows who he's going to start against Scotland. I find it really hard to look at the kind of the last two friendlies and say that they won't have kind of altered his mind a little bit at all. You know, the first of those two games against Denmark played really poor but ground out a result. The second with a kind of more likely, well, something closer to the starting 11, I think we'd expect to see against Scotland. They played really well, but they just weren't clinical at all up front. And that's sort of been a little bit of a characteristic of his entire tenure in charge, is that they've just not been able to get the goals when teams go deep. And that, I think that's where they're going to really struggle. On the formation and stuff, it's going to be really interesting because Neville disagrees with the team over what the preferred formation is. He hasn't said which prefers which, but one of them prefers 4-3-3 and one of them prefers 4-2-3-1. And that will obviously change who he's going to put into the starting 11. The hard thing is they've got to be really quick off the mark. You know, there's no easy fixtures for them, whereas you look at the US, who have got Thailand, Sweden and Chile. Sweden will be a tough game for them, but the other two they should completely walk, so they've got kind of like a nice ease into the tournament. So I think the hardest part is being clinical and just kind of instantly clicking and being quick off the mark.
Ada Hegerberg will not be playing, and there's sort of new, there's been an article, an interview with her explaining her decision not to play for Norway.
Norwegian magazine Jossimar, which, you know, full disclosure, I do some work for occasionally, as does Philippe, have done a very long interview with her because she's been quite vague about why she walked away from the national team. It was after the Euros in 2017, and initially she said it was about the entirety, the leadership, planning, preparation and execution. So most things were wrong, I guess. And for several years she's kind of kept away from the subject. She goes into some detail in this interview, which was conducted a few months ago, where she says that she always felt she couldn't express herself, that it wasn't an environment she thrived in. She mentions a lot of specific things like the FA not giving them good equipment, and the facilities being bad, the training being not so good. She mentions, like, once she did an ad campaign for free because she thought she was just going to turn up and do it, and she later learned that the men, having done the same ad campaign, were paid a lot of money for it. There's a lot of little things like this that just created an atmosphere where she felt she couldn't be herself and couldn't perform. And she actually said she was shattered mentally and totally depressed from playing and having nightmares from playing from after the national team camps. So that's very bad. This has kicked off in Norway a bit, because should be stressed, this interview was done several months ago as part of a special edition of the magazine, which is 100% devoted to women's football in Norway and the story of women's football in Norway. But it has come out this week on the eve of the World Cup, which has obviously caused a bit of distraction for the team. Martin Ødegaard, of all people, have piped up and wrote on Instagram, "Perhaps you can find something better to do than to disturb the national team's preparations for the World Cup. They've qualified for the World Cup with their country, one of the biggest things a footballer can experience, and they've already had enough negative attention. They deserve better. That you now decide to do an interview like this is totally impossible to understand. The timing is horrendous. Your decision not to play for Norway is yours, but respect Norway and our national team. It's enough now," says Ødegaard. Which is a bit of a strange addition to the debate, because she's not criticising the current setup or the current team. She's just explaining why it didn't work for her, why she had a bad time, why she felt she had to walk away, and trying to highlight the fact that she feels institutionalised low priority, was a phrase that was used. The statement from Ødegaard was actually cleared with the FA. Both the national team manager of the men's, Lars Lagerbäck, knew of the statement before it was put out, and the head of press from the FA saw the statement. So there's at least a tacit agreement from the FA there, or at least they haven't told him to maybe not do this, which is quite extraordinary. So this is a complete mess, really.
I thought it was really strange because, like Lars said, she did the interview quite a long time ago. I mean, the game mentioned was back in February, I think. Mm-hmm. So it was clearly, you know, she didn't have much control necessarily over the timing, and clearly haven't given it much thought. It's a big feature on the history of women's football in Norway. Struggle is a massive part of that. So the idea that you don't include her in that, and you don't have any articles on the history of women's football in Norway in the build-up to a World Cup, is a little bit beyond me. I think every country has got something similar. But I think it's a really strange situation because she has been so vague. It does give you a little bit more detail, but she has always said that she's come out of the national team feeling like she's a worse player for it, and that there's no freedom to express herself on the pitch or in the dressing room, and that's been coupled with a frustration of how far behind Norway is falling internationally, development wise. And for me, the biggest question is, like, do women footballers sometimes put up with too much? Because you know there's loads of examples. Sky Blue, team in the National Women's Soccer League in the US, a story broke last year about their, like, really kind of bottom level appalling conditions that the team were having to deal with, not even having proper showers and things like that. And then you had when Neil Redfern resigned, Chris Kirkland took over as interim manager at Liverpool, and there was an article on the BBC where he said he had had to buy beds for the players because they'd be given apartments without any furniture and things like that. And there is a feeling, like, how much do women footballers have to put up with? You know, she's the best player in the world. She's being treated extremely well at Lyon, and you know, she's got a position where she's able and feels comfortable making a stand. And you know, I think it's very, very distasteful to criticise her for the timing of an interview.
I guess it says a lot, and maybe even underlines her point, that when she makes her complaints in the manner that she does and tries to explain what needs to get better, the whole debate ends up being about the timing of her saying this and whether or not she should be allowed to say it. That is point. I guess in the interest of balance, I should mention that there is another side to this. During the Euros, there were reports in the media that she had broken internal disciplinary rules, that she'd broken curfew. There have been suggestions that people within the setup find her difficult to get on with, that sort of thing. But I guess that we are accustomed to extremely gifted and extremely driven sports people not always being diplomats and not always being easy to deal with. I should just mention that there is another side of it as well.
All right, cheers, Lars. Not to mention how confused the person at the till at IKEA when Chris Kirkland tries to buy 17 beds is. Finally, Susie, you published your exclusive on the alleged abuse in the Afghanistan Football Association today. Can you remind us of that story and the fresh developments?
Yeah, so obviously towards the end of last year, published a story about the abuse of the sexual abuse of national women's team players in Afghanistan by the president of the federation, but also some other staff members of the federation were accused of abuse at the same time. That's been rumbling on in the background. FIFA are on the cusp of announcing what kind of punishment they're meting out to the president, Karamadam Karim, within the next couple of weeks, I think. The story we put out yesterday was that we'd be given basically a bunch of emails that showed this was reported to FIFA going back to the start of 2017, to the tops of FIFA, to the tops of the AFC, and to the tops of the Afghanistan Football Federation, and nothing was done. FIFA's excuse in their statement to me was, I think, particularly frustrating, we've never been given any proof of this or anything to back it up. So we get emails like this all the time, and we can't follow them up unless there's evidence. Now, one of those letters is a letter signed by 34 provincial presidents in Afghanistan. It's not like just that someone shot off a little gripe to FIFA and they've just kind of palmed it away. This is 34 of the 36 provincial presidents complaining to them of corruption, of sexual abuse of players, of women players, and of abuse of young boy players as well. And originally FIFA had said that they had only heard of the abuse at the start of 2018, and that's when they launched their investigation and immediately sprung into action on it. But these emails suggest they knew about it at least a year before that.
It's brilliant that you've unearthed that story, Susie. Listen, enjoy the opening ceremony, enjoy the first game, and it's coming home.
No, don't say it.
I've said it before on the pod.
You've done a wobble there, Max.
I've been wrong. I've been wrong so many times. Cheers, Susie.
See you later.
Susie, right there, the Guardian's women's correspondent. She'll be on the pod all the way through the summer as we cover the Women's World Cup. And that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll start with transfers. Then it'll be Philippe's FIFA Hour. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Eden Hazard to Real Madrid, an £88 million deal agreed in principle. Real apparently doubling his wages. Good move for him. Creates a bit of a headache for Chelsea with their transfer ban, but arguably the most expected transfer.
Which they've just appealed against the transfer ban to TAS today.
Okay.
So we shall see, because TAS can move very slowly or very, very quickly. Okay. They finally made their appeal.
If they appeal it, does that mean the appeal is...
Yes, if the appeal is not heard, the transfer, or rather registration ban, is lifted, or rather pushed forward.
Okay,
it's a well-known tactic.
You buy as many people as you can, and then the ban comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
and getting up to 100 or even beyond 100 million for a player who has a year left on his contract and really doesn't want to be there is spectacular business by Chelsea.
Will it be exciting? It will be exciting to see him in a Real Madrid shirt, isn't it? I mean, there's more for Real Madrid to do, right? Christian Eriksen's the next one.
Well, Jovic is in.
Jovic is in, you're right. How good is Jovic?
Very exciting. And it's good to see him blossom, because he's been a name that's been talked about for so long. I mean, years and years, he was known as, he was meant to be like, I think I heard the phrase, the Serbian Falcao, like 4 or 5 years ago when he was still...
Which Falcao are you talking about?
Exactly. But like, he's been a known talent who never kicked on the way everyone expected. And then now he finally has. And I'm very excited to see him at a top club.
Do you think Eriksen will go to Real Madrid? I mean, because Levy wants 120 million, which is clearly way more than he'll get. And there is this continued criticism of Eriksen that when the really big games happen, he doesn't necessarily show up. He's a beautiful footballer, but I don't know if that accusation is fair or not.
Well, I guess it's more a question of whether or not Real Madrid can get Pogba, because surely they're only doing one of the two, and Zidane, from the sounds of it, really wants Pogba. If that's not possible, maybe Eriksen. But again, for Spurs' perspective, he's got a year left on his contract. There's not much to suggest he'll sign a new one. Spurs are not really a club that can afford to see an asset of that value leave for free. So at whatever Levy says and whatever the public posturing is, I suspect they'd quite like to sell him this summer.
To be fair, Eriksen did score a hat-trick against one of the best Republic of Ireland teams of all time, Barry, didn't he?
Yeah, and then he'll have the opportunity to do so again tonight when Ireland played Denmark in the Euro qualifiers for the fifth time in, I think, 3 years. And we're as sick of them as they are of us. Their players have been doing, you know, sort of tiptoeing around trying to not to insult Ireland's style of play while doing exactly that. And who could blame them? I suspect Ireland might actually beat them tonight just purely by boring them into submission. Victory by
Homer Simpson style.
Familiarity.
Mass outbreak of neck injuries in the Danish squad from just watching the ball fly over everyone's heads.
Tomorrow, Wales go to Croatia, Northern Ireland travel to Estonia, Scotland host Cyprus. Daniel James to Manchester United could be Solskjaer's first signing at United. I mean, exciting.
I kind of like this, because it's not a big investment for them by their standards. Obviously, he might not be at United's level right now, but he's got raw pace, and it's one of those things, if you're really quick as a winger, you've got something going for you.
Does pace ever ripen?
I guess
pace is often raw, isn't it? But I've never heard anyone.
Well, it certainly, you know, becomes rotten at some point.
Well, that's true. It just goes from. There's no. Is it like a pear that is only ripe for a very short amount of time? It's raw and then it's finished.
Or the kind of avocados that you get 4 for £1 on the street market.
But I think it is a little bit interesting. Pivoting back to football, with apologies, Max.
So it's your show.
Yeah, indeed. That United. They've definitely tried for Jadon Sancho. That doesn't look like it's happening. They've definitely tried for De Ligt, which doesn't look like it's happening. They're going for James now. There's a much more of a younger skew here. There's a departure from putting very big, slightly older names on massive money. That seems to be a strategy they might be putting behind them.
United are sort of like, you know, those Angus steakhouses you see around London now. A landmark institution, but no one really wants to go there.
Have you ever been to one?
No.
Lars?
No, in my childhood, we were in London with a family we knew, and the patriarch of that family angrily walked out of an Angus steakhouse and sort of demonstratively ate at a McDonald's the next door because the food was late and bad. Okay. Which I think is that has scarred me for life. So I'm
it's
not going
it's my fault for requesting Angus Steakhouse.
Yes, it is.
Anecdotes even before we'd start Philippe's FIFA minute. Neymar's going to miss the 2019 Copa America, which is in Brazil, after rupturing a ligament in his ankle during their 2-0 friendly win over Qatar in Brasilia. He was stripped of the captaincy in May, limped off after 17 minutes. Richarlison put Brazil ahead after 16 minutes. Gabriel Jesus got the other goal. And World Cup 2022 qualification started on Wednesday in Ulaanbaatar with Mongolia versus Brunei. Mongolia won 2-0, also grabbing early wins. Macau, Bangladesh, Cambodia and Bhutan. And where was that stadium, producer Jonathan, that our friend James Montague tweeted a picture of in Bhutan? I mean, it's got a pagoda across one entire side of the pitch. He took a photo of it through part of the stand. It's got the mountains in the background. It is almost as good as the view of the allotments at Cambridge United. Right, FIFA time with Philippe. You went to see Gianni Infantino. He's been re-elected as president of the Football's World Governing Body for a second term. Well done, Gianni. It was a very tough contest. Yep. He had no opponents. He's been re-elected until 2023. And it quotes, nobody talks about crisis at FIFA anymore or rebuilding it from scratch. Nobody talks about scandals or corruption. We talk about football. We can say that we've turned the situation around. This organisation has gone from being toxic, almost criminal, to being what it should be, an organisation that develops football and is now synonymous with transparency and integrity. I don't believe you can counter any of that.
They were rolling in the aisles.
This is absolutely extraordinary. And to say that as well on the eve of the French police descending on the Hotel de Berry to go and have a nice chat with Ahmad Ahmad, the president of the African Confederation, that's quite something. Yeah, I mean, we were struggling with the colleagues who were at the Palais d'Exposition, Porte de Versailles, cavernous building, perfectly suited for FIFA, absolutely no soul whatsoever. Because what happened is that they decided we're going to change the statutes now. Okay, guys, we're going to change them now so that, first of all, we're going to vote. Can we change the statutes so they come into vigor? Oh no, come into play straight away. So they vote, 202 votes for, 3 votes against. Okay, so we can change statutes. Now, because there are no people against Gianni Infantino, could we actually elect him by acclamation? So can you vote on that? 202 votes for, 3 votes against. Those three guys, by the way, are my heroes. I don't know who they are, but they're really my heroes. So Gianni had left the room.
That's good.
Because obviously he couldn't be there, to make it fair. And then came back on stage to the strains of Seven Nation Army.
Oh, no.
Complete with all the lyrics and everything, because he had been acclaimed. And then he came to the rostrum and in a broken voice broken by emotion, told of his gratitude for having been given this great opportunity to bring football forward and so forth. It was absolutely typical of an organization which is turning into could you call it an organization any longer? I don't know. It's basically a great body which seems to be moving in the wake of Gianni Infantino's decisions.
Will the headquarters soon be just like a giant Gianni Infantino head, sort of big shiny temple when you walk through his mouth into it?
Something like that.
Oh, sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it was. And then the fun carried on because at the Hyatt Regency, the delegates from the African Confederation were there. And as you may have, as you know, and there were some very serious trouble at the African Champions League final, namely, I don't know if I need to repeat what happened.
No, it was a VAR. One team wanted VAR, one team said no. They called the game off, gave the victory to one of the sides. It's being replayed, right?
The Wydad Casablanca players scored a goal which was valid, sort of, but the referee disallowed it, and the VAR was not working.
That's right.
And the Wydad Casablanca players decided, well, that's it, then we're leaving the pitch. And then there was, I mean, absolutely surreal scenes. The trophy was given to the Espérance de Tunis. But then CAF, in its wisdom, decided after 2 days of talks to replay the final So Esperance will have to give the trophy back. We haven't got a clue as to when the final is going to be played, because 8 of the Tunisian players are already with their team for the African Cup of Nations. It so happens that the chairman of Wydad Casablanca, Mr. Said Nasseri, is a very good friend of the president of CAF, who finds himself in a very difficult situation. And he found himself in an even more difficult situation when, yesterday morning, he was asked by police to collaborate with their inquiries about a possible alleged tax evasion, failure to pay VAT and all these sort of things, scandal linked to a couple of French companies and which is linked to CAF. President Ahmad has since been released by the French authorities. So it's an important thing to mention.
That is important.
But the story is developing, and watch that space. It's going to be interesting times and rocky times before the AFCON starts in just 2 weeks' time.
You should, Barry. You'll play it again, Sam Gag, last pod.
Was remarkably prescient.
Deserved more and has turned to be true.
Yeah.
You were about to say something else.
I was about to say how prescient my play it again.
Fair enough.
Casablanca joke was.
All this Infantino stuff happens at the time when former UEFA president Lennart Johansson passed away at the age of 89.
Who was a truly good man, by the way.
Minute silence in the last two Nations League games. Finally, you wanted to mention Manchester City, Philippe.
Yes, it's quite extraordinary. As you know, when Manchester City is in some trouble with UEFA over the fair play, financial fair play regulations, namely about, of course, overvalued sponsorship deals, but also perhaps the use, and again, the alleged use, let's be clear about that, of companies to pay some Manchester City employees, namely Roberto Mancini. And they've decided to go to TASCAS and the Court of Arbitration for Sport to try and kick out the UEFA investigation into touch by saying it was basically irresolvable and that it there was no legal foundation to UEFA pursuing that particular course of action. So they haven't said we haven't done anything bad or anything. They're trying to kick the whole process into touch by legal terms.
So they're not actually appealing a decision against them. No, they're appealing an investigation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. A really nice story from QPR. They're going to rename their stadium after a charity. They said that in April. Today they've announced that they're going to rename it the Kai and Prince Foundation Stadium from the start of the upcoming season. Kai and Prince was a striker in their youth academy. He was stabbed to death in May of 2006 when he was just 15. His father, Mark, set up the foundation to help educate young people about the consequences of knife crime. He said, "I can't tell you what this means to Kai's mum, to me, his brothers and sisters, his friends and people who have been supporting the work we've been doing. This gives us so many opportunities and we have to make sure we capitalise on them." So look, well done to Queen's Park Rangers. A couple of things from Monday's pod. Ball presentations. Noah says, you were talking about the little car that drove onto the pitch before France-Bolivia. Barry said it rang a faint bell, having seen it somewhere before. I think he's remembering the 2012 Olympics when tiny remote control Mini Coopers were used to drive and pick up the javelin, discus and hammer. The judge would put it into the car. It would be driven back to the throwing point for the next contestant. I know because I was one of the drivers, he says.
Fantastic.
I did once take my eye off the ball and drive it into the leg of one of the judges. But I was sitting in the very middle of the stadium for the entire Olympics, not much to complain about. Theron says, in regard to ball presentations, the fraternity I was in at university would have a big volleyball tournament each spring. During the opening ceremonies, a member of the fraternity studying to become a commercial pilot would fly a training plane over the house at regulation height. I don't know, is that 36,000 feet? I don't know.
No.
And drop a ball out the window, I hope not, and be sucked out, trying to land it in the backyard. The closest it ever got to the house was just inside 2 miles. And Tom says, the best ball drop was at Twickenham. A giant sea eagle was supposed to fly from the stadium roof, drop the ball on the halfway line, and then fly to the other end. All started well. Giant eagle drops the ball. But instead of flying back to the roof, it got confused and flew into the crowd, all the time being shown on the big screen. As it approached the fans, the screen promptly went black. I never found out what happened to us. And the most response we got after Monday, Barry, you won't be surprised to know, is what you keep by your bed. Thank you to David Squires for drawing Baz the Super Soaker Sniper. Great attention to detail. Luke has a question.
A bit too much attention to detail, because he made a very small but very significant error in that. In the excellent cartoon he drew, I was smoking a cigarette, which no sniper would ever do, as it would give away your position.
Very good point. Unless everyone in Brixton is smoking out their windows, in which case it would help.
Yeah, possibly.
Luke says, if Scott Brown was being rowdy down Barry's street one night, would he have the balls to super soak him?
Absolutely.
And Matthew says, does Barry recommend a specific type of super soaker? Having similar trouble with raucous drunks near my flat, want to take matters into my own hands, Glendenning style. Stuck between getting the Soakzooka or the more discreet Microburst 2. Any advice appreciated?
I can't even remember what make mine is, but I think it's all about range.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Surely some weapons suit some people, right? Follow your heart, I would. Whatever feels comfortable for you.
Yeah, fair enough.
Excellent. I'm so pleased we can go from FIFA to Super Soakers in such a short amount of time. We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.